today on Against the Grain. Is life worth living? Can believing in something help make that something a reality? Do emotions precede actions, or is it the other way around? I'm CS. We'll revisit a conversation with John Keg about his book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Philosophy to help us live, to help us live better, more fulfilling lives. Philosophy to help us understand human nature, to grasp our ability to make choices, take action, exercise free will. That's the kind of philosophy William James professed and practiced, and that's why John Keg and so many others have been drawn to the insights shared by James in writings and lectures like The Will to Believe and On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings. The power of willed belief, the influence our actions can have on our emotions, the question of whether life is worth living. These are some of the weighty issues taken up by William James and addressed in Keg's new book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life. When John Keg joined me recently, I asked him what James, the philosopher and psychologist who was born in 1842, what James meant when he used the term sick souls.
William James used sick souls to describe a range of people who see life and see the universe through a sort of pessimistic lens. When you wake up in the morning, if you're a sick soul, you feel like life is sort of out of whack with the universe. And James had suffered through depression and anxiety through the 1860s, 1870s, and was very familiar with this mental disposition. He contrasted this to healthy-mindedness. These were two characterizations that he gave in the Varieties of Religious Experience, written close to the turn of the century. But James was describing modern anxiety and modern depression. Probably for our listeners today, he was describing the feelings and mental dispositions that many of us are facing today in the pandemic, in fact.
You write that James's entire philosophy from beginning to end was geared to save a life, his life. So William James thought about ending his life?
He did several times through the 1870s. And he asked the question, is life worth living, throughout his life, even when he pulled himself out of his suicidal moments? James gave a lecture in the 1890s, 1895, called Is Life Worth Living, to address basically a crisis on Harvard's campus, six suicides in the last year. And the answer to that question, is life worth living, is the springboard for Sick Souls, Healthy Minds.
Let's talk a little bit about William James's upbringing. You note that freedom was the enduring touchstone that guided family life, the life of the family in which James was raised. Talk about that.
So William James was born into a life of privilege, deep, deep privilege. His grandfather had been an industrialist and a real estate mogul in upstate New York, and he had given his father, William James's father, Henry Sr., a huge amount of latitude in what to do with life. Henry James Sr. pursued a mixture of philosophy and spirituality and religious studies and landed in Cambridge in the 1860s. William James was born in the 1840s, and he was given, like his father, a huge amount of latitude over what he should do with life. And he experienced something that many of us do, some of us do, have the both privilege and also the sort of drawbacks, that privilege is sort of the place where anxiety abides. In other words, when you have so many choices in front of you, oftentimes you don't know which way to go. And that was James's experience, and he was born into a family of little geniuses, Henry James, the novelist Henry James, and his sister Alice James was also quite definitely a genius. And so James grew up wondering whether he should go into science, whether he should go into philosophy, whether he should become a painter, and settled into a mixture of philosophy, religious studies, and psychology. He's the founder of American empirical psychology, and he's the founder of one of the founders of American pragmatism, a distinctly American philosophy.
So this issue of freedom and free will in the midst of this privilege was important to William James and his father. Tell us about his father's relationship with Calvinism and the extent to which his father felt like he needed to move beyond it.
Calvinism circulated through New England in the 1820s as sort of the predominant force, religious force. And so American transcendentalists like Ralph Waldo Emerson and then also his friend Henry James Sr. saw Calvinism, and particularly the doctrine of predestination and the sort of strict father morality that came along with Calvinism, as being problematic. They saw it being antithetical to the sort of freedom that the Romantics and then the Transcendentalists and then, for William James, the Pragmatists were after. And Henry James Sr. Turned to a lesser-known religious figure known as Emanuel Swedenborg. He was a Swedenborgian. And Swedenborg had a mystical experience, what he called a vastation, a deeply mystical experience, a transcendental experience, an emptying out of all of your sort of human or physical materiality and communing with the absolute one-on-one. This was about as free as you could get, and Henry James was both fascinated by it, but then claimed also to have a vastation of his own, which stood outside of the organized religion of, you know, Calvinist New England. It was much more akin to what Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson were after in the 1840s. William James followed his father, but not quite as religiously. What I mean by that is that William James, pursued transcendence in many forms, in using nitrous oxide, hiking great distances, testing his freedom in many different ways, and also being interested in psychical experiences, seance sitting. But he didn't hold to the Swedenborgian line of vastation quite so stringently as his father. So he looked for sort of secular ways of transcendence rather than a sort of more traditional religious route.
And I want to return to this issue of transcendence that James was pursuing, but I want to focus a little bit more on free will and free will in relation to determinism. So William James thought and wrote a lot about what he called the dilemma of determinism. Determinism is about the extent to which our lives are determined by forces outside of our control. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, James was growing up at a time where the determinism debate was flourishing again. What had happened is that modern science had really begun to dominate the way that we think about the world and the way we think about ourselves. And modern science is, to a large extent, dictated by the principle of causality, the idea that one event causes another, and you can trace these causal events back infinitely, so that every event is caused by a previous event, which means that the decisions that we make in life also are caused by previous, oftentimes physical, events and dictated by the laws of nature. And this scared James to death, because what it implies is that we're not in control of our lives, that the choices that we make aren't really ours. And this was made even more pointed after Darwin published The Origin of Species in 1859, because to that point, we had been able to say that human beings were somehow different than the natural world, that we weren't simply operating by causal forces or natural law. But after Darwin, and right when James is, you know, coming of age at Harvard, there was this sense that, you know, human beings are just like any other animal, just like any other biological organism, and therefore dictated by natural law. And what James is fighting against in the 1870s, and also what causes his depression in the 1870s, was the sense that either we are completely in a chaotic world, complete indeterminism, where we don't have choice, or everything is in lockstep fashion in a sort of hard deterministic way. And James's philosophy, I think, is trying to think through meaningful action and free action.
And this relates to the issue of fate, too, right? That if the world is totally determined, then we are fated to do and be what we do and are.
That's right. And additionally, it goes back to a very old religious question known as the problem of evil, which is the sense that life is A, not in our control, and B, that the divine power or God allows really horrible things to seemingly happen, and that they are completely out of our control. And James was quite concerned about this, and he understood the dilemma of determinism, this crisis of free will, as being closely related to this question of the problem of evil. How do we make the world a better place? How can we make the world a better place if we're fated from the outset?
John Keg joins me on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. He teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, and we are talking about his new book. It's called Sick Souls, Healthy Minds: How William James Can Save Your Life. So as you said, William James contemplated suicide. Did he see free will operating or possibly operating in a person's decision to take his life, take her life?
That's a really interesting question. First, I will say that James combated the dilemma of determinism with the help of a Frenchman by the name of Charles Renouvier. And he read Renouvier's essay on liberty in the early 1870s, and James concludes that the first act of free will will be to simply decide, to simply believe, and to simply act as if he were free. This comes across later in his famous Will to Believe essay. But your question about suicide and about the relationship between suicide and freedom is one that James thought a lot about. And it's one, frankly, that I've thought a lot about. And James's answer, so he asked the question, is life worth living? And usually this question is answered in two mutually exclusive ways, yes or no. And if you say no, and if you say it ardently enough, eventually you'll no longer be with us. And if you say yes, you join the host of Western philosophers who have come up with really good systems like Leibniz or Kant or you name it, that make a convincing argument why life is always 100% worth living. Now, James, who had struggled with depression through the 1870s, came up with what at first I thought was a complete cop-out of an answer, but now that I'm 40, I think it's probably the best possible answer, which goes to your question about freedom. James says that the answer to the question, is life worth living, is maybe, quote, it depends on the liver, unquote. And when I was 20, I thought, gosh, that's such a cop-out. But now, having lived a little bit more, I think what James was saying is that it's up to us. It's up to us to live. It's up to us whether we want to take our life. It's up to us to make life worth living. And what James never wanted to do is to turn our lives over to forces beyond our powers. He wanted to say, it's up to you. Whether you can make good on life's possibilities and also face its perils. And I think that that's one of the messages of the essay and also the lecture, is life worth living. I mean, one of the follow-up questions is, how free are we, really? And I think James had a pretty sophisticated answer to that. He would say something like, there's a 20th century philosopher, Viktor Frankl, who says that between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space is where we act freely. And I think James has something similar to that response. And I think that he's always interested in life's possibilities, even when they seem to be, you know, few and far between, and that we're controlled by lots of forces beyond our control.
What James also seems to be saying is that we shouldn't judge someone else's decision or understanding of whether his or her life is worth living. It sounds almost like we have to let that person decide for themselves. We can't decide that for them.
I think you really touched on an important issue here. I mean, if you think about the question of whether to take your life, many people, I'll speak from my own experience, because I think that's all James would have us do for now, is that when I'm in bouts of depression, I don't want someone coming along and saying, of course life is worth living, obviously. I want somebody to come by me and say, maybe tomorrow will be a different day. Maybe life is worth living. It's up to you, John. And I think the feeling of being disempowered, the feeling of apathy, the feeling of not being able to make your own way, is what causes many people to fall into suicidal ideations and depression. And what James is suggesting, I think, is that we need to respect the feelings and the sort of mental disposition and the choices that individuals make. I additionally think that James is very much aware. He has this essay called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings. And he says that, in this essay, he says that when we look at other people's lives, we have a lot of trouble understanding that their inner lives are as vibrant and real as our own. Very often we simply project our own thoughts, feelings, lives on other people. And James thinks that this is a sort of default self, you know, self-obsession that all human beings have. It's a certain blindness in human beings. But it is within our power to get over it, he thinks. He thinks that we're able to look at someone else's life and say, hands off, to some extent. In other words, maybe we should allow them to speak for themselves if they can, allow them to try to articulate in a sort of even groping way what they are going through. And I think that that's something that James in his later life did both with his students routinely, but also with his loved ones and the people that were closest to him.
This seems to me a very profound point, John, and you delve into it in your book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, that there's a self-centeredness, as you were saying, that we're all kind of afflicted with, if you will, that prevents us from fully considering and thinking about other people's situation, what they're going through, where it's, you know, the adventure is ours, it's in our minds, and it tends to dominate how we view the world, how we view everything.
I think that's right. And I mean, I think James is very honest about how difficult it is to break out of that natural self-centeredness. He tells a story in On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings where he's in Appalachia in the mountains, and his tour guide is taking him past what he calls coves, which are basically what he regarded as hovels, where miners and where farmers would live. And his first thought was, my God, these are the ugliest places I have ever seen. And he admits that. And then he thinks, how narrow is my vision that I can't realize that these places where individuals live are as vibrant and real and meaningful to them as my Irving Street home in Cambridge. And I think that at the turn of the century, 1903, this is a pretty interesting and important moment, both for James, but also I think in the history of social and political philosophy. James is usually not regarded as a social or political philosopher, but I think that if you look carefully, we find an interesting ethic behind the scenes in his philosophy. And I think it's something like this, is that James took suffering very seriously, and he was enough of a student of Arthur Schopenhauer to realize that maybe the best that we can do in life is to be companions in misery. What I mean by that is that if you look around the world, you know, suffering is not the exception, but rather the rule. It's ubiquitous. And James is very good on a certain blindness in human beings, is that our response to the suffering of others isn't simply to project our own sufferings on them, to understand it through our own lens, but rather to realize that suffering, the suffering that other folks are going through, is as unique, as alienating, as isolating, as painful as the sufferings that we ourselves go through, which I think is a very sort of like Buddhist conception, an interesting conception for a white Boston Brahmin to give at the turn of the century. And I'll say one last thing, and then I'll sort of, we can turn elsewhere. But James, I think, in On a Certain Blindness, is suggesting that our moral communities be broad because they are linked through suffering, not through common suffering, like we all suffered together through the same pains, but rather each of us suffer in our own unique ways. And that difference, that inability to understand fully each other, is in fact the commonality that underpins our moral communities. And I think that that's a deep thought for James to express. I also think that it's, if we think about the commonality or the universality of our moral communities, usually we hook them up or put them together by virtue of common loyalties or common affinities. Perhaps it's better to think about the absolute differences and based on what he called a type of rich pluralism, meaning each of us are living our own unique lives, and what sort of communities can be based on that.
John Kaag is his name, K-A-A-G. He's the author of American Philosophy, A Love Story, and Hiking with Nietzsche on Becoming Who You Are. We are talking about his new book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life. It's just out from Princeton University Press. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Let's turn back to this question of belief. You were referring earlier to James's assertion that my first act of free will shall be to believe in free will. And this brings up the question, and this was very important to William James and to yourself, of the beliefs that we acquire, that we choose to adopt. Did he believe that our most cherished beliefs are grounded in a kind of objective certainty or empirical proof?
It's a great question. So William James wrote an essay called The Will to Believe, which is oftentimes misinterpreted. In it, James says that there are questions in this world that are empirically proven or disproven. And when we have recourse to empirical evidence, we should always take it. In other words, questions about the laws of nature, some of the questions about the laws of nature, some logical questions, all of these can be answered and justified either in empirical or formal ways. Great, James says. And when we can supply empirical evidence, we should take it. James, however, believes that there are many questions that do not afford empirical justification. And in other words, they cannot be solved strictly on empirical grounds. Like some of the most important questions that we face in our lives today. So, for example, who should I love? Should I get married? Am I a moral person? Is life worth living? Is there a God? These questions for James were not the types of questions that could be answered fully or exhaustively through empirical evidence. James thinks that volitional belief, in other words, belief based on will, is justifiable in these cases. What he means by this is, when you are considering whether to fall in love, whether you're wondering whether you're falling in love, it is justifiable to will yourself in it. Okay, my mother used to say, fake it till you make it. In other words, if you are wondering whether you are going to, for example, take a leap across a great precipice in the mountains, this is one of James's examples. He says, when we look at the gap, right, we must believe that we can make it. Otherwise, we surely won't. And I think that this has been pivotal in my life. And it doesn't always work. You don't always make the jump effectively. But if you don't believe, you certainly won't. And I think that this is one of the cases that James thinks through and applies it to many of our social interactions.
Yeah, in a famous 1896 lecture that James gave called The Will to Believe, he took up the question that we all ask many times to ourselves when we meet others, the question, does this person like me or not? What did James have to say about that?
Well, James believed that if we doubt ourselves about our likableness, we usually take on a sort of dour or quiet, introverted way, which may not elicit the response of being liked. But if we, as my mom says, fake it till you make it and put a smile on, it is more likely that you will receive the feedback that the world, in fact, likes you just fine. And what James is also doing is hooking this up to, or relating this closely to, his theory on the emotions. In the early 1890s, James founds what becomes known as the James-Lange theory of emotions. And in this theory, James says that we don't feel something, feel an emotion, and then act on behalf of it, but rather that we act first, and then our feelings catch up to our actions and reflect our actions. See, he's saying something a little bit the same in The Will to Believe when he says, when I come across somebody and my outward comportment or the way that I carry myself reflects that I don't believe that the world will like me, the world will probably not like me. And in contrast, James believes that if we carry ourselves in such a way that we believe that the world will greet us rather than shun us, the world is more likely to greet us.
So in other words, believing in something and willing yourself to believe in something, even if it's not, if it hasn't been proven to your or anyone else's satisfaction, choosing to believe in something has what, according to James, the effect of making it more likely that what you are believing in will manifest?
Correct. That our belief itself changes the world to conform to our belief. And I think, I mean, one of the critiques of James's Will to Believe is that some commentators rightly say, well, this is easy for you. You come from privilege. You're white. You're a man. Of course you think that belief will change the world, right? Of course you think that just, you know, believing a certain thing will change the way that the world greets you. And I think that this is a very strong point. James, however, I think, would be sensitive enough to both admit that fact, but then also push the critic to say, isn't it the case if we succumb to quietism or just succumb to apathy, whether our apathy or quietism might be justified then by the world? So I think that it's both a trenchant criticism of James, but also possibly a point where James would say, we can still believe, or one can still believe.
Yeah, and as you write in this book, I'm not sure whether you're kind of quoting or paraphrasing William James here, but you write, acting as if the world is a tender, welcoming place, occasionally has the effect of making it more so. I'm speaking with John Keg, and his new book is Sick Souls, Healthy Minds. We'll take a short break and speak more with John about his very interesting book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. John Keg is my guest. His last name is spelled K-A-A-G. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And his book, his latest book, is called Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life. Let's talk more about what you began to say about James's theory of emotions. So you said that whereas most people think that actions follow emotions, I have an emotion and then it manifests in certain things I'll do, whether it's clench my teeth or laugh or do whatever I'm doing to display, in some sense, that emotion, that James had it the other way around. Could you talk more about that and maybe give us an example of an action that James thinks would be followed by an emotion as opposed to would follow that emotion?
Absolutely. I mean, James was actually interested in treating depression, his own and also the people around him. And he says quite clearly, he says, if you are feeling down or if you are feeling depressed, the last thing you want to do is get up and move. But in fact, moving, any type of movement, but also certain types of movement, can actually change your emotional state of being. So he suggested, if you're feeling down, stand up and do basically what yogis call a sun salutation, which is to put your arms up above your head, to look up, to lengthen or open your glottis, the part of your throat that sort of allows you to breathe clearly, and take a few very deep breaths. And James will say that this should just give you a hint of the James Lang theory of emotions, which is you might feel horrible, right? You might feel really down in the dumps. But if you change the way that you hold yourself or change your posture, your body actually changes the way you feel. And he's very close friends with a group of individuals who bring yoga to America. And James's theory of the emotions is reflective of the fact that certain types of postures, certain types of activities change the way that you feel. Not that you have to feel them first and then you act accordingly, but that you actually can act first and then your emotions change. I see this a lot. I mean, we live fairly close to a state park, and before the pandemic, there weren't many people out walking, but there are a bunch of people out walking now. And I think it's not just I think they're getting a clue or getting hints that moving your body through space actually changes your emotional disposition as well.
If someone like myself is angry, is rageful, and my inclination then is to scream or to, as I referred to earlier, clench my teeth or just lash out physically with my limbs. Is William James saying that if you don't do that, C.S., that emotion might pass more quickly?
Yes, exactly. And he's also, I mean, there's a very old theory of the emotions. It's in Aristotle. called catharsis, where you vent your emotions, and you vent them in sort of safe ways, and then you don't have to deal with them later. James thinks that oftentimes when we express our emotions, that we then give rise to even deeper and greater emotions. I think that he would agree with you that if you lash out, you're more inclined to feel like you want to lash out more.
In what ways does James's theory of emotion relate to his effort to reject determinism and assert the existence of free will?
James was a reader of the Romantics and the Transcendentalists. But the Romantics, Goethe especially, say the action is the thing. In other words, action is primary, and thought, well, thought has its place, but we need to act. And I think that James's theory of the emotions, which places its emphasis on activity over some sort of internal feeling, is a reflection of this, and also a response to the idea that we don't have control over our actions or our decisions. So, for example, when I am depressed, or when I am anxious, I may not have the mental wherewithal to talk to myself and change my mental state, but I may have the ability to still choose to act, to go for a run, to go for a walk, to change the way my body is being held. And those are small but very significant changes for human beings like us, according to James. So I think that it is a response to the feeling that life in the universe is beyond our control. He's saying take small measures to cultivate particular types of habits, bodily habits that then translate into emotional ones.
You quote William James throughout this book, and let me read one passage. Most people live, whether physically, intellectually, or morally, in a very restricted circle of their potential being. They make very small use of their possible consciousness and of their soul's resources in general, much like a man who, out of his whole bodily organism, should get into a habit of using and moving only his little finger. What did he mean by this, and did he see any way out of this situation, this predicament?
I think it's an important point. James thought that we are habitual creatures, that humans are remarkably habitual creatures. And this is to follow Aristotle and any number of philosophers before him. He says, James suggests that our lives consist in the main of the habits of life, that we find routines, that we put blinkers on, that we can only see certain things. And in fact, those habits oftentimes are helpful heuristics or helpful shorthands to get through life. But James is also very much aware that our habits tend to narrow our angle of vision to the place where we can't see originality, can't see possibilities, can't see the way that life might turn out. And so James was on the lookout for possibilities. In fact, he's on the lookout when he says that life is worth living. Well, maybe it depends on the liver. At the end of that lecture, he says something I think is really important. He says, if you're not satisfied with a maybe to get you through life, maybe you should consider all the ways in which the maybe possibilities function in everyday life. He says, take the examples, right? Take some examples from your life that you find most meaningful. My students oftentimes say, like, when they fall in love, or when they kick a extra field goal, or when they, take a test and succeed. And I pose to them something that I think James would also say, which is, if you knew the outcome before those meaningful events or meaningful activities, would you find them as meaningful? Would you find it meaningful if you knew how a love affair was going to go, or a love relationship was going to go? Would you find it meaningful if you knew how a friendship or how a piece of music was going to be played out? And James would say no, because it depends on a maybe, which is to say, a possibility. That maybe things will work out one way, maybe they'll work out another. In part, it's up to us, James repeatedly says. And I think that that's James trying to get back to the issue of determinism and also to encourage us to act and to encourage us that we have some authorship over our lives.
So if William James was suggesting we could use more of our consciousness, he certainly was interested in doing that. And you referred earlier this hour to his use of nitrous oxide. Was that part of his effort to sort of become more aware of and awaken to the full range of experience? And I'm also curious what else he thought might be alternatives to taking laughing gas.
So James did see nitrous oxide as a way of opening your mind well before Michael Pollan did his book on it. I think that James's experiments with hallucinogenics was an attempt to open his mind beyond the sort of standard ways that we close it through the habits of life. I don't think that that was the only way that James did it. His relationships with students and with his peers were remarkably open and risky. He took a lot of latitude and took a lot of risks. He did things that other professors wouldn't do. He actually allowed questions from the audience, for example, in his lectures. Oh my goodness. But I mean, what William James went for or looked out for were spontaneous chances in life. He was always interested in finding them and looking for them. And I think that that's what he did in his teaching. He was a brilliant teacher. And also what he did when he went to the Adirondacks, which he did repeatedly, and to a place that he loved, Shikoroa, New Hampshire, up in the White Mountains. He saw nature as providing possibilities and chances that were outside the normal purview or outside the normal scope of our social dealings. And he's right. When you go hike on a trail and you go out on the trail, you don't know what you're going to encounter. And I think that that's something James would encourage us to do. I think something that James missed out on, but that Jane Addams, working in Chicago, did, is that the urban setting also provides similar opportunities as long as we're willing to open our eyes in new ways. James came to San Francisco right after the great earthquake and saw it basically firsthand and saw how urban renewal could be a possibility, how urban disasters happened. And he was, I mean, frankly, he was thrilled by the prospects. He also thought, oh my gosh, that disaster sometimes can be a way of drawing people together. That's the sort of upshot of his moral equivalent of war, an essay that he pens in the first decade of the 20th century.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. John Keg joins me to talk about his new book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life. We have a link to that book and to more information about John on our website, againstthegrain.org. What did William James, think of large institutions and big ideas?
Famously, James is against bigness in all of its forms. He was living through an age of imperialism and was disgusted by America's imperial drive, which is interesting in part because James also seems to, in other places in his writing, seems to be quite forceful in his adventurous and expedition spirit. But when it came to bigness, when it came to institutions taking over people's lives, James was against it in all forms. So this went for expansion in the Pacific during James's age. But he also could look back and think back on Henry David Thoreau pushing against the Mexican-American War. He sees himself in that sort of intellectual lineage as pushing against a government that overreaches and that insists on taxing people for wars fought in their names, basically.
And perhaps he was against governments or governmental structures partly because they tended to constrict free action, which he was so concerned about promoting?
I think that's right. I mean, he was against institutional religion for the most part, although he understood that it gave meaning to many people's lives. He was also suspicious of government's effects on individual creativity, individual action, individual choice. And so he's pushing back against this at a time when governments become bigger, much, much bigger.
One thing we haven't talked a whole lot about is, and it's a big part of your book, is your own experiences, which you share in vivid detail. I mean, you confess to a number of emotions and experiences. You're very honest with what you've been through and your attempts to deal with adversity. You write that, "I think that William James's philosophy saved my life, or more accurately, it encouraged me not to be afraid of life." Elaborate on that.
I came into philosophy as an undergraduate, and I was drawn to thinkers who addressed psychological suffering, psychological tension. So I was drawn to thinkers like Nietzsche, Simone de Beauvoir, Sartre, but also the American thinkers, primarily William James. William James wrote The Principles of Psychology in 1890, and usually we regard it as the beginning of empirical psychology in America, but really I think it was an instruction manual for how James could understand himself and understand his darker moments. And those moments have been pretty prevalent for me. And I struggled with depression, anxiety, and eating disorder through my 20s. And I find that James doesn't let you dwell in self-obsession, but rather gives you ways out of it. And I found that to be life-giving. I found that to be really meaningful as a young man. I'm 40 now, and I've returned to James after two divorces and heart surgery, open heart surgery. And again, James says, "Be not afraid of life." And I think what his message is even in the pits, the maybe remains. In other words, the maybe of life's worth does not forsake us even in our darkest moments, which is to say that you can end it all if you want. It can be a trap door. Suicide can be a trap door. But you also have the ability to keep that trap door closed. The maybe remains. And I think that that's been really worthwhile for me as last year I had two heart attacks and then surgery. And I never thought I'd be in this situation. I never experienced pain or being out of control like this. And James's maybe was always there. Maybe tomorrow will be different. Maybe you can make good on life's possibilities. Keep going. Be not afraid of life. And I think that that's, for me, that's what James has meant. It's about life and its amelioration. And that's enough. And that's it.
Can you share with us one habit, something you've incorporated into your life fairly regularly that was inspired by reading William James?
Yes, I'll say two. One is that I am now a yogi. In other words, the James Lang theory of emotions pushed me into becoming, I won't say a yoga fanatic, but a hardcore believer in the power of yoga. The second is that endurance athletics is something that I picked up through James. James famously, when he was 56, walked 3 4,000 foot mountains in basically 2 days, which was a lot for him. And what I've realized over time is that endurance athletics, it doesn't matter about the speed. It just matters if you can put one foot in front of the other. Or in my case, I swim a bunch now. So those are activities that I take and use them as my Jamesian practices to sort of regulate the emotions. And also, let me add this, that William James believed that philosophy is principally not about writing in very sort of narrow academic journals or about going to specialized conferences. It's about teaching, and about teaching in a very personal way, in a way that teachers and students work hard together to figure out the way that philosophy can inform life. And that means that when you write, and when you read William James, it means that when you write, you try to be understandable to a very large number of people. And I've taken that from James. When James writes, he is writing to the widest possible audience. And it's inspired me to try to do the same.
Well, let me say that I think you've succeeded in that. Your book, Sick Souls, Healthy Minds, How William James Can Save Your Life, is very accessible. It's written for a wide audience. The author of that book and my guest is John Kaag, K-A-A-G. He teaches philosophy at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. His other books include American Philosophy, A Love Story, and Hiking with Nietzsche on Becoming Who You Are. John, thanks so much for writing this book and for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, C.S.
And that interview first aired last August 10th. And this is C.S., suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.